This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street, provided by radio all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with an interview with an author of a brand new book, I Am a Stranger Here Myself, and it's an interesting idea, the way the book is put together and the story it tells. Today we're joined by Deborah Gwartney from Finn Rock, Oregon, and Deborah is the author of the book. Thanks for joining us, Deb.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why did you write I Am a Stranger Here Myself?
Well, I think I had many reasons for that. I worked on the book for about 7 years, so I have to go back to my younger self to ask, what in the world were you up to with this giant project? But I think a couple things. First, I had come across a book about Narcissa Prentice Whitman, who happens to be the first Caucasian woman to cross the Rocky Mountains in 1836. She was with an entourage of missionaries. There was another woman there, but Narcissa was first. And she settled near Walla Walla, Washington, and she and her husband were the first Caucasian couple to, you know, start a mission and a family, and they died horribly 11 years later. And I just looked at that story and thought, what does this story mean to me as a woman who lives in the West as well? I became very intrigued with her and studied her for about 5 years before I started writing. I also wanted to tell the story about my upbringing in the West in Salmon, Idaho, a little tiny town in the Bitterroot Mountains. And just, you know, I always felt like a little bit of a misfit there. Adored my family, generations of family lived there, and but never quite fit in. And I've always been curious about what that was in me that always felt a little bit like a stranger.
So this book is a bit of a hybrid. It's a history and a memoir, your story and Narcissa's story as well. Yes. So tell us about the parallels or the reason for this juxtaposition.
Well, it took me a long time to figure out why I was telling both stories at once. It was a tricky business, and as you said, it has an unusual structure for that reason. But what I finally figured out was that Narcissa, for me, was a really interesting pry bar into that idea of who belongs, who doesn't belong, and why we have this kind of primal desire to belong in a place. And when we love a place and yet don't feel like we quite belong there, it causes this dissonance that can stick with us for the rest of our lives. And she came west, you know, not exactly of her own accord. She was fired up for her version of God, of course, but she was really pushed by her mother, by her church, to come out and do this work, and she was terribly ill-suited for it, and just it just worked. It was just a disaster for everyone involved, and so she, you know, she just didn't belong. And I had this feeling that even though my family had deep, deep roots in Idaho, I struggled to belong. And so this theme of belonging became centrally important to me, and I thought I could use her experience to understand myself better.
Well, the first chapter in your book, I Am a Stranger Here Myself, ends with this sentence, "For reasons I have yet to decipher, I can't seem to make peace with the place I've loved best on this earth." So I guess that's where we are right now in this discussion. Tell us a bit more about Narcissa Whitman, because when she makes this trek west, is it along the Oregon Trail or what became the Oregon Trail? I mean, this is the 1830s.
That's right. So this is another reason why I'm so fascinated with her, is that she basically, you know, and I'm overstating it a bit, but she basically started the Oregon Trail, because she and the other missionary woman with her, whose name was Eliza Spaulding, the two of them were the first women to take a wagon of domestic goods across the Rocky Mountains. And once they did that, and Narcissa was pregnant at the time, once that happened, people, women in the Midwest and you know, in your area, started thinking, hey, if she can do it, I can do it too. And so it really was the opening of the Oregon Trail. So, you know, you might know that 300,000 people followed the Whitmans over the Oregon Trail, and I really think of her as the, you know, the great grandmother of that trail. And part of one of the folks, the wagons on there belonged to my family, and so I thought she kind of forged the way for the rest of us. And you know, but the irony being that the news was that this wagon got over the Rocky Mountains with the Whitmans, but in fact, the wagon had broken down so badly it was just a little cart by then. But nobody heard about that.
Well, Narcissa Whitman and her husband Marcus were missionaries, as you mentioned, and this was during the period of what was known as the Second Great Awakening. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I'm not a scholar, so I might wobble a little bit on this, but from what I've read, my understanding is that the Second Great Awakening started in upstate New York around the Finger Lake District, and Narcissa's mother got totally swept into it. And it was a rejection of the old Puritan Calvinistic beliefs. And for the first time, believers were told that they could have a direct relationship with God. This had never been promised to followers or believers before. But these people came together in these huge revivals where for the first time there were lots of singing and speaking in tongues and people were asked to line up and give their lives over to God. This had never occurred before, and it was a massive movement, and it spread all over the East Coast and then into the Midwest. And as I said, Clarissa, Narcissa's mother, was one of the first big believers, and as soon as Narcissa was born, she thought, I want my daughter to be a missionary, because spreading the word of God became imperative.
And, of course, who she's spreading the word of God to are the natives indigenous to that part of what became the United States. So this is an interesting project.
Yes. In fact, Narcissa and Marcus came out with a very strict idea of Christianity. In fact, they told the people who lived with them that, you know, if you were a Methodist, you'd go to hell. It was It was a Presbyterian belief system that I can't really wrap my head around. I think, what are the tiny little differences between these religions? But, boy, they held on to them. So they came out, they preached to the Cayuse, the tribe they lived among for 11 years, and not one single Cayuse person converted to their religion.
That's probably because they had their own belief system, I suppose.
They happened to have their own belief system, yes. And then, of course, the Cayuse band, a small band of Cayuse, came to the mission on November 29th, 1847, killed both of the Whitmans, and really made sure that they suffered, and then they killed 14 others, and then took 50 people hostage for a month. It was a really terrible situation for everyone.
Well, this takes us back to the title, I Am a Stranger Here Myself, because obviously Narcissa and her husband were strangers in a strange land to them, and here you are. So let's talk now about Deborah Gwartney.
As I said, I'm a fifth-generation Idahoan. I was born in Salmon, Idaho, which happens to be also the birthplace of Sacagawea up there in the Bitterroots. And I grew up with this very strong sense of place, very strong. My family had, as I said, deep roots there. And they had, now that I'm way into middle age, I can look back and realize that they had some of the same attitude as Whitman's, not the religious part, but they believed this land is ours to take away from the native people. This land is ours to do with what we want. And it just was unsettling to me. I don't want to judge them. This is how progress was made then. And I see that. And Manifest Destiny was a huge movement. But what I grew up thinking was, why are we cutting all these trees? Why are we, poisoning these streams with cattle? And, I just had these ideas that didn't sit well with my family. And so I grew away from them politically. And I also was very troubled by the relationship with the native people there, the Shoshone. And I don't know where those ideas came from in me. I think because I was a big reader. And I'm not saying that I'm better than my family. I was just different from them. And it just caused a strain that I've tried to sort out most of my life.
In the book, there are four main sections in which you kind of provide this parallel between your life and Narcissa's experience. The first one is the then end of something. The pioneer era ends, in a sense. Expand on that idea for us. And you.
Well, the settlement of the West was really, they decided over in about 1860. So it was you know, people were still coming in, but that great big movement, the Oregon Trail immigration or migration, ended around 1860, and people were flooding into the Willamette Valley here in Oregon, especially because the land was so fertile. You know, I recently read Prairie Fire, Carolyn Fraser's book about Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I was stunned by the parallels that people were sold the same bill of goods. You know, come here and we will give you free land and your life will be perfect. You won't suffer any illness or misfortune. And, of course, that was just not true at all. There was a lot of misfortune, and it was a much harder life than anybody thought it would be when they headed out. And yet, you know, people stayed, and they built a beautiful civilization out here. It's just that Native people paid a huge price for it. So, you know, what's the right answer about that? I don't know, but I think my family and Narcissa were pretty blind to what was happening to the Native people.
Well, the next section is plucked from the grave, and this is where measles, one of the things that happened to the Native people because of it was brought to them by the European settlers, Narcissa and others, and the Cayuse attack that ended their lives.
Yes. Yes, illness played a huge role in this. I didn't realize till I started reading that most people died on the Oregon Trail, most white people died on the Oregon Trail, certainly not from Indian attack. They found very few of that happening, but from illness. Illness wiped out a great swath of people. About 12,000 people died during those years, and of course they were just buried right next to the water, so that just created more problems. And a lot of animals died too, so the Oregon Trail was pretty disgusting, I think, toward the end.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, they were bringing these illnesses west, and the Native population just had no immunity with these pathogens. White people have a little bit of immunity because maybe our great-grandparents had that strain, but it killed off Native people very quickly. And, in fact, several books I read said that by the time the Cayuse attacked the Whitman Mission, every single Cayuse child in the encampment was dead.
Hmm. And there was probably the belief that the white settlers who survived at a better rate were getting some sort of preferred treatment, huh?
Yes, Marcus Whitman was a doctor, and they did believe that Marcus was curing the white people and killing the Cayuse children. They truly believed that, and I think, you know, it looked like that was what was happening.
The next section is called River of No Return, and there's a very interesting parallel experience between you and a river and Narcissa's family tragedy with a river.
Yes, that's right. My extended family went on a river trip on the Salmon River, our river, next to my grandparents' house, when the river was closed because it was in flood stage. But, you know, the men in the family said, oh, what the heck, we know what we're doing, let's go. And we were in a pretty serious rafting accident. Everybody survived, thank goodness, but it was life-changing for me because I thought I was certain that I was going to die out there in the water. And I parallel that with the drowning death of the Whitman's only child, Alice. She was 2 years old and drowned in the river behind their house. And I just found a lot of interesting letters that Narcissa wrote about that time, and I think it just shut her down in a way that she never recovered from.
Mm. Well, the final segment is Memento Mori. It's a warning, a reminder of mortality, so expand on that idea as you tell it in the book.
Yes, well, part of why I wanted to write this last section was that I discovered in my research that that after Narcissa's death, men became obsessed with her hair. The Cayuse had smashed her skull in, and also Marcus's, because they believed that would keep them from the afterlife. And her hair was spread around the compound. And so the men who came to rescue the survivors started picking up her hair. And for some crazy reason, maybe someday I'll understand, her hair is in archives all over the country, including Yale University has some of her hair. People saved it and then donated it. So there's a lot of Narcissa's hair around. So I really wanted to look at that idea of why would somebody hold on to this piece of her hair to remember her. And, you know, I also wanted to look at my last grandparents parent. My grandfather died about 8 years ago, and I wanted to look at that profound death in our family and how it's changed us.
How do you think this book is being received by your family, or will be?
Yes, yeah, so I just saw my sister and brother, and they were very pleased by the book. They liked it. I mean, they said they remembered the raft accident a little bit differently, but, you know, that's what's going to happen because, you know, we all have our own memories of that day. It was a scary and severe day. But we had a great talk about it, and they really liked the themes. I have not yet heard back from my father. I'm curious how he'll feel about it, but I wrote him a letter and sent him a book, and, you know, it's a scary thing for a memoirist to send it out. But I wrote this book about myself, not to blame my family in the least. I have no feelings of blame. I have no desire for retribution. I just wanted to explore myself, and I hope that they all see that.
Well, you've done another exercise in introspection. You wrote a book before this, a memoir that was titled Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters. Wow.
Yeah. Yes, that was an intense book, too. Yes, my teenage daughters, when we moved to Eugene, Oregon, which was a, you know, very liberal town, and it was at that time in the 90s, there was a big anarchist movement here that they got pulled into.
Well, Ken Kesey was out there.
Yes, Ken Kesey was out here.
Yeah.
And anyway, yes, the two of them, when they were 14 and 16, jumped on a freight train and left home. So it's a book about finding them and bringing them back.
That would be terrifying. And I have been out in that part of Oregon several times myself. And in Portland, there are probably as many homeless kids as you'll ever see in any place.
Yes, it's really true. It's rampant. And, you know, my book took place 10 years ago or so. And so it's even gotten worse. And it concerns me a lot. These young people are being misled and promised something that's just not true. And so I wanted to write about that and a parent's plight when your kids get involved in something like that.
You know, when we talk about writers, it is a lonely sort of art form, and it is one that is very introspective, that word again. And writing a memoir can be maybe like peeling a bit of your flesh a bit.
Yes.
You teach writing. You teach in the MFA program at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon.
I do.
How do you try to explain your craft and the art that might result from it to your students?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I had wonderful teachers, especially Philip Lopate and Vivian Gornick. They shaped my idea of what a memoir is. And, you know, a memoir is about self-excavation in my view and in their view. It's about, you know, something that's not settled in the self and looking in there and asking yourself with great honesty, why am I unsettled about my past in some way? And so we talk about that a lot in the classes I teach, how to excavate, how to bring that out and look at it in an honest way. And, you know, to say to yourself, I'm not a victim, I'm a player. I was involved in this dynamic. And to explore that in a way that that really brings meaning to the page in a way that readers can resonate with. So that's the kind of memoir I just value and cherish and try to write, you know, not one out of blame, but about self-examination.
And, of course, to share emotions, you have to know what they are and come up with some way of expressing how they feel so that's communicated.
Yes, that's right, and it's very difficult. I have so many people tell me, at the beginning of the semester, oh, I thought writing about my own life was going to be a cinch, but it's the hardest thing I've ever done.
And probably the most important thing, at least as a young person writing, to make that kind of discovery.
Yes.
What are you working on next?
Well, I'm still kind of in the thrall of this current book, but I promised my grandchildren that we would write a novel together. So I've never written fiction, but I thought, what the heck? I'm going to write a young adult novel with these kids and see what, just have fun with it.
All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us today. It's a very interesting read. I recommend it. I Am a Stranger Here Myself by Deborah Gwartney. And you have a website, Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, Gwartney, G-W-A-R-T-N-E-Y.com. Thank you for being with us today.
I am so grateful to you and your wonderful questions. Thank you so much.
Coming up next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Shen Yun presents 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes, and storytelling. Through classical Chinese dance, Shen Yun shares diverse ethnic and folk traditions, filled with orchestral sound. May 5th at the Chester Fritz Auditorium in Grand Forks. One performance only, tickets at shenyun.com. S-H-E-N-Y-U-N.com. Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us today. Trees are prominent in a landscape, and because they can take years to reach maturity, trees can indicate the landscaping fashion of a time. Chuck Lura is a naturalist who shares his knowledge of the animals and plants where we live in his Natural North Dakota essays. And today, Chuck's essay is about a tree that has become very familiar, the green ash.
We have several green ash trees near our house. You probably do as well. Green ash is one of the most widely distributed ash species in the United States, with its native range occurring roughly from the Great Plains eastward. Plus, it's widely used as an ornamental. Green ash is quite tolerant of both drought and flooding. It can also tolerate a wide range of soil conditions and is winter hardy. That wide range of tolerance to environmental conditions is a big factor as to why green ash has been a species of choice as an ornamental and other tree plantings. It's perhaps the most successful tree species used in shelter belts, particularly here in the northern Great Plains. It might surprise you, but ash trees are members of the olive family. The olive family consists of around 600 species of trees and shrubs around the world. As one would expect, the family includes olive trees, but also includes some other interesting plants such as lilac, privet, forsythia, and jasmine. Although most everyone is familiar with green ash, I suspect that few North Dakotans know that there's another species of ash native to our state. Black ash can be found in Pembina County, and the species is also getting some use as a landscaping plant. It differs from green ash in that the bark is gray rather than a darker colored. Also, black ash usually has 9 leaflets compared to the 5 to 7 leaflets found on green ash. After Dutch elm disease felled elm trees across our region, green ash became the tree of choice for tree plantings. Elms were almost exclusively replaced by green ash in yards, along boulevards, and parks, around farmsteads and other areas. Green ash is probably our most widely distributed tree. But the future, however, looks rather ominous for green ash. Back in 2002, the exotic emerald ash borer showed up in the United States and Michigan. It's devastating to green ash, killing the trees in as little as 3 years. And it's coming our way. It's now been documented in Winnipeg, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and Sioux Falls. I've not seen statistics on the mortality rate, but it appears to be comparable to that of Dutch elm disease. It's likely just a matter of time before it spreads to North Dakota, unless someone can quickly discover an effective method to stop it. If you have some green ash in your yard or farmstead, now might be a good time to begin considering something to replace them should they succumb to the borer in the future, especially when you consider how long it takes to grow a good shade tree. But when you choose which species to plant, select a species that's not so abundant in your area. And if you want to plant several trees, please don't plant the same species. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, sharing the news about gravitational waves in a Native American language and a cutting-edge podcast about experiential learning. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Mandan police say several dead bodies were found in a Mandan business this morning. Police responded to a call for medical assistance at about 7:30 a.m. When they arrived at RJR Maintenance, they found several bodies. Deputy Chief Lori Flayton says police will hold a 5 p.m. news conference on the incident. The Morton County Sheriff's Office and the Bureau of Criminal Investigation are also involved.
What a difference a week makes.
Fargo City Administrator Bruce Grubb says with equipment and materials standing at the ready, the community is at a good place when it comes to the threat of flooding. After seeing forecast numbers that caught the attention of officials, an ideal thaw pattern has allowed those concerns to be lowered. Grubb says the region is still at risk of seeing flooding, but at this point the crest is expected to be lower than originally thought.
In Fargo now, we have sufficient sandbags and clay identified, so we will hit the pause button and stand at the ready if called upon.
As the concern for river flooding lowers, residents of rural Cass County are still on alert for possible overland flooding. Cass County Engineer Jason Benson says there is still a lot of snow that needs to melt and a lot of roads that could be impacted.
So in the past, we've had upwards of 150 to 200 road closures on our county road network. And then, you know, there's probably double that on the different township roads.
Benson says the goal is to make sure residents have the needed tools and supplies to make it through the flooding should they get cut off by high water. And the Senate has changed its stand on the pay plan for state employees for the 2019-2021 biennium. The Senate originally proposed 2% raises in the first year and 3% the second year. The House was at a 2-2 plan, but the House changed to 2% the first year and 2.5% the second year. That's the plan the Senate has now adopted. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg says in the first year, state employees would receive a minimum of $120 per month raise and a maximum of $200 a month.
All state employees earning less than $72,000 each year will receive a $120 salary increase rather than a 2% increase. That means that, Mr. President, 75.7% of our state employees will have more than 2%.
Senate Democrats had pushed for a 3-3 plan, but Senate Minority Leader Joan Heckman said she would support the proposal.
And it'll give our state employees a little bit of increase in salary that they haven't seen in the past few years, and I think it's important that we do that. While we would have liked to see 3 the second year of the biennium, the entire package here is good.
The Senate passed the pay plan as a part of the Indian Affairs Commission budget 46-1. The plan will now be added to all state budgets on the Senate's side. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today, scientists restarted their search for gravitational waves after a year spent making improvements to massive twin detectors in the United States. Discoveries should soon start rolling in, and when they do, there's a good chance the news will be translated into a Native American language called Blackfoot, or Siksika. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Gravitational waves were predicted by Albert Einstein more than a century ago. They're like the ripples you see in a pond when you toss a pebble in. Only these waves move through space-time, the very fabric of the universe. They're created by powerful collisions like two black holes smashing together. And the first detection in 2015 made history.
It was just a life-changing experience when we had that first detection.
That's Corey Gray, a physicist who works at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Washington State. He says this discovery involved over 1,000 people from around the world. So before the amazing first detection was publicly unveiled, colleagues started translating the press release into about 20 major languages, Russian, French, Spanish.
I thought, whoa, wouldn't it be just really cool if we could get this translated into an indigenous language?
Like Blackfoot, also called Siksika. It's spoken by only a few thousand people. Gray's mom is one of them, even though when she grew up, the U.S. and Canadian governments were actively working to stamp out native languages.
By taking kids away from their parents and sending them to boarding schools. So my mom is a survivor of that.
Boarding schools were set up to assimilate children.
That's his mom, Sharon Yellowfly.
And the purpose of this assimilation was to get rid of our language, the customs, the traditions, you know, everything that we grew up with.
At these schools, speaking Blackfoot got kids punished. Corey Gray says that's why he doesn't really speak his family's language and why he wanted to see it represented in a major historic event. Yellowfly says when her son asked her to translate this gravitational wave announcement,
my emotions were all over the place. It was shock.
She agreed to try with the help of relatives. She had to create new words for heavy scientific terms like general theory of relativity.
And the word that I came up with that was Bisatzinsiman. And the translation for that is beautiful plantings.
Her son recorded her reading the final translation.
Kipipui akastuis epsiksisamo Einstein ikaisksinim.
Corey Gray understands more Blackfoot than he can say, but he knows what his mom came up with for gravitational waves, or stick-together waves, as she translated it.
For that one, I could kind of say it, and I'm probably strangling it, but for that, it's Epudux Bisia och Begemsgeist.
He loves sharing this with younger people.
That's the thing I'm really excited about, just to be able to go and see indigenous youth and youth from my tribe, and just tell them that there is a connection with our language to Einstein now.
Meanwhile, as scientists keep detecting more gravitational waves from colliding black holes or neutron stars, his mom continues to translate the press releases.
I guess I will do these as long as Corey wants me to.
And doing this has renewed her interest in another project, writing a Blackfoot dictionary. Yellowfly started jotting down words at the age of 23 after she noticed kids speaking English more and more. For years, her parents were her main source of words. She stopped working on her dictionary when they died, but now she says she needs to finish it for the next generation. Nell Greenfield, Voice, NPR News.
That report first aired Sunday on All Things Considered. Next on Main Street, a cutting-edge podcast.
My interest in the blues sprang from several different sources. My dad had Louis Armstrong records at home, and I became fascinated with Louis recordings with the Hot Five and Earl Hines. About that time, Dinah Ross portrayed Billie Holiday in the film God Bless the Child. I became fascinated with the music of the gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt. My dad had Les Paul records, and I read the liner notes and discovered that Django was Les Paul's hero. My ears became very comfortable with the recordings from the 30s and 40s. It wasn't too long before I discovered Eddie Lang and Lonnie Johnson, Leroy Carr and Scrapper Blackwell, Blind Blake, Blind Willie McTell, Blind Willie Johnson, Reverend Gary Davis, the Empress of the Blues, Bessie Smith.
Nobody knows you.
The first time I ever heard Taj Mahal was on a record called Recycling the Blues and Other Related Stuff. On the cover of that album is a great picture of Taj sitting with one of his biggest influences, the one and only Mississippi John Hurt.
Make me a patty.
What a discovery this was. By the time I walked into the KFJM studios back in 1984, I was a pretty serious record collector and music fan. I loved it and jumped at the opportunity to do a show on the radio. The Saturday Evening Blues Cruise was born. Hi, I'm Mike Olson. Join me Saturday nights for the Saturday Evening Blues Cruise here on Prairie Public, 9 Central, 8 Mountain.
Fly Lemon Jefferson and Zeus BMWs, the Blue Force, the Abacana, Book of White, Book of G, James Brown.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. When it comes to learning, experience is an excellent teacher. That's how West Fargo English teacher Beatrice Hill runs her classroom. She advises students who are doing the hands-on work of publishing a school magazine titled Ex Primera. Hill and student Corey Draught join host Tom Gerhardt in this excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast.
As a type A personality, that for sure is something that can be alarming. I think the students that approached me that first year were so excited and energized that I just ended up not having too many fears because they just seemed so determined to get it done. And when they approached me, I literally had no knowledge of InDesign, which is the program we use to create the literary magazine. And that's probably what intimidated me the most. But what has been such a unique part of this experience is that students every year have taught me new tricks with the program, and I've really learned that program through students. And so when I say the first year it was entirely student-led, it totally was, and really has continued to be. But I think that's a great skill for us to have as teachers, to really allow students to kind of open up their wings in our classrooms and foster that innovation.
I'm sure it's extremely rewarding, too, mm-hmm. to sit back and be able to be a guide, but to see them flourish and not every day I'm sure is perfect and rosy, and mm-hmm. but to see them come across problems and situations and be able to work their way through them together.
Yes, oh, for sure. And And last year, I would say, is probably we encountered one of our largest challenges where our saved document suddenly became or disappeared. And so we were reaching our final deadline and tensions were high. But our editor last year kind of problem solved on her own and figured out how to get the task done at hand. And that was a great example of the students really coming together. When I probably had more reservations, I wasn't really sure how it was going to get done in time for our deadline, but they pulled out all the stops to make sure that it was going to happen. So,
Corey, you were in the middle on that. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more just because that's exactly the kind of situations that we're looking at as we're looking at how education is moving forward. What was that like when suddenly, because I've been there, you realize what you've been working on is gone.
Yeah, it was really crazy because we had already been like coming in early before school to finish some things up and staying after school late, and we had done all of this hard work and then it just disappeared and everyone was going crazy trying to figure out where it was, and then she ended up just putting it all together when we couldn't find it, and it was really cool.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see these kids overcome challenges and make them opportunities, I guess, in some ways. You mentioned earlier, Beatrice, kind of encouraging everyone to be a part of this literary magazine and what that can do to a student body. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, as you were sending me some things for the podcast here, that you've worked closely with the Gay Straight Alliance, Minority Inclusion Association, Art Club, and other media programs, newspaper, yearbook, broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And just that thought of getting, or at least giving the opportunity for all voices to be heard. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important to you?
Well, as an English teacher, I always feel that, you know, writing and reading and art are perfect outlets to express yourself and to gain a wider understanding of who we are as human beings and develop that sense of empathy for others. So that's something I value as a teacher, of course, and this literary magazine truly emphasizes that. And our third edition of the literary magazine was called Rebellion, and we viewed that as, you know, students really do have a voice and we wanted them to feel empowered by that. And so we really reached out to groups that year to show how many types of student voices we have in our school. And I think it's easy to think that when you're in North Dakota, you might come from a homogenous community when in fact that's really not the case for most of our schools in the state. So I think highlighting all of the good work and good opinions that students have and showcasing that is important.
And I've visited with Leah Jelke at Fargo South and her English learners and how important it is to tell your stories, I guess, probably no matter where you come from.
Of course, yes.
And Corey, you touched on this earlier too, when you have to work with a wide variety of people, that you have to listen, you have to collaborate, you have to communicate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're talking about here, too, taking all these voices and trying to make one unified product. What's that been like? Talk about maybe even some of the struggles, but then some of the outcomes that have been extremely positive, too.
I think it's just really cool being able to have something like this bring so many people together. And there's a lot of different people that have different things going on in their lives that they can use writing or art or anything like that and put what goes on in their life into something like this. And we can share it with our school. And it's just really cool being able to do that for all the different people in this school.
And you said you had a sister and it'd be cool to join and be part of this process. But what is being able to express yourself, however you choose to do it, through this literary magazine? What does that mean to you, and why has that been important for you?
I think it's really important because you're not always able to get your point across to the people around you in just your everyday life. And sometimes it goes a little deeper inside of you. And I think writing it down or making art or something like that and being able to share it with more people is just really cool.
And what do you see from your fellow students along those lines? Kind of the same thing? Or what are you hearing from them? And how good does it feel when you see a finished product?
I think they like it about just as much as us, because I remember last year in my English class when the finished product was all out and everyone was seeing the things that they had created being put in the actual magazine, they were all like oohing and aahing at it and everything, and they thought it was really cool. And I think seeing that made it more real, and it made me realize that everyone really enjoys what is put into these magazines.
And as a student and from a student perspective, is this kind of work along this line that you're considering for your future, or has it opened up some possibilities for you?
Yeah, it definitely has. I've always been the one to enjoy writing, and I've always really liked creative things like art and writing and everything like that. But doing this has like brought me into the aspect of like media and journalism and making things online like we did for the magazine. And I've been considering doing things like this in my future, like with being an English teacher or things like that.
And sometimes it helps to figure out what you don't want to do by experiencing something. We talked about selling advertising in a media like this literary magazine. There are a lot of facets to getting it up and going and off the ground and out to the public. And I know you mentioned fundraising was another part of it, and that's another learning opportunity for your students.
Yes. The way we are funded is entirely because of our own drive, I guess. We've been working concessions every year, and our first year we reached out to local businesses, and I really had my students be part of that because this was their publication and I wanted them to feel ownership with that. So when we went to meetings with businesses, I encouraged them to come with me, and they actually created a brochure to hand out and indicated like what the business would get from us in return and that kind of thing. So I think that was a new experience for me as well. And I thought it was extremely valuable to do that with my students and for them to truly lead it too and see kind of what it takes to get something like this off the ground.
And there's such authentic experiences too. I just think of these things and I would assume someone like Corey, you'll remember these things 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road instead of Miss Hill just perhaps sitting at the front of the class and talking for 40 or 50 minutes. Why? I mean, that's so critical in this day and age, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, just the people skills alone. And, you know, of course, not every business will be able to donate. And, you know, how do you approach that type of rejection? Not that it's serious rejection, but how do you handle that? And then when you maybe do get rejected, what's your next step? So kind of that problem solving process too. And kids are always getting creative with how we can get more money too. So they always have new ideas for me.
Corey, have you been part of the fundraising process? You have. I see you shaking your head.
Yeah. Earlier this year, we did concessions for a football game and we stayed there for a majority of the night just to raise money so that we could do this.
So you really, I mean, you're putting your money where your mouth is, right? You're out there making sure that you're helping get the literary magazine ultimately published each year.
Yep.
I thought it was really cool, too, that you mentioned you've had some open mic nights. And sometimes people ask me, well, how do you hold a student or a project accountable? But I think when you have your students presenting to the public, that they're going to want to make it the best that they can make it for a presentation. Tell me about these open mic nights and what that has meant.
So our first year, my students really wanted to celebrate what they had accomplished that year. And so they kind of asked, what could that look like? And, you know, what could we do to make it happen? And so I thought that was an amazing idea as well. And we actually reached out to a local coffee shop downtown, the Red Raven, and they let us use the space. And we reached out to another teacher that works at our school, and he provided like guitar background music in the evening. And we were able to hang up student artwork there, and students performed throughout the evening. And that was just really satisfying in so many ways because both, you know, my colleagues came out and students came out, and I of course had a small fear that what if no one came, and of course our school community proved that wrong and they really showed up for us, which was just an incredible feeling. And that has continued to grow, and most recently, we held an open mic night at our high school in the library, and that was really exciting too. And the kids brought in like a rug, and you know, of course, made it artsy. And that year, we probably had over 70 people come, and so that was just really great to see too. To just see more students coming, and the evening actually went for quite a long time because kids had so much to say and share, and so. Kind of got to the point where we're like, okay, this will be the final performance because we'll get kicked out of school soon.
A good problem.
A good problem. Yes. Yes. Good problem.
As we're looking at experience of having a student-led literary magazine, mm-hmm. what tips or tricks or best practices would you pass along if someone else was looking in another school to let their students take an idea like this and run with it?
Yeah. I guess every year, you know, we have conversations about, you know, what does it look like for something to be student run? Because, of course, you can't just say, like, how about it? And I'll see you at the end of the school year. So I definitely think you need to have a conversation about expectations and, you know, what student roles look like. And, of course, when you have so many personalities working together, you also might need to foster some conversations that maybe are uncomfortable just in the sense that, you know, creative ideas come in conflict and maybe they don't agree, like, this is what needs to go in or this is what does not need to go in. So, you know, fostering those skills that allow them to break down maybe more challenging conversations, but also let them make thoughtful decisions and consider all perspectives. So I think providing the expectation of, and maybe even modeling what that looks like and how you want that to work out is one of the most important pieces. And then I guess the second important piece is probably just to step back a little bit and know that it's okay for things maybe not to look like the way you anticipated. And more often than not, they'll surprise you with all their ideas and it will turn out for the better. So,
Corey, how about some tips you could share maybe for other students that would like to participate in something like this?
I think students should just go for it because I know that I was kind of scared to try things like this, especially my freshman year, but I told myself that I was going to get involved more last year and it really turned out good. I really enjoy this club and I'm going to continue this year and next year. And I think without taking that leap of faith and joining something new, I wouldn't have experienced this. And I think that more students should try things like this.
Corey Drott, Jr. at West Fargo High School, and Beatrice Hill, English Language Arts teacher at West Fargo. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Cutting Ed podcast host Tom Gerhart. The Cutting Ed is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, and entrepreneur Ted Dentersmith. You can listen to the podcasts at ndunited.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
There are many ways to listen to Prairie Public. We've got mobile apps, streaming via our handsome new website, prairiepublic.org, which just got a makeover. Through smart speakers like the Amazon Echo, just enable the skill and ask you know who to play NPR or Prairie Public. And are we forgetting something? Oh yeah, you can listen to Prairie Public across the state of North Dakota on a good old-fashioned radio. That's right, it's just like when you discover that the music you like listening to is now considered classic rock. Yeah, it kind of hurts. Radio, still kicking it after all these years.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 1st. The Air Rifles girls' basketball teams in the 1930s played in what was called the North Dakota High School League. Two players, Lucille Mohn and Doris Boyd, were on teams that won 109 straight games. The streak began in 1938 with 27 wins in a row. In 1939, they went 19-0. In 1940, 20-0. 17 more wins in 1941 made it 83 in a row. By the time the streak reached 100, the Rifles had outscored their opposition 4,409 to 1,087, an average of 44 to 11.
It was prehistoric basketball by modern standards. Perhaps these days the score would average something like 88 to 22. Regardless, the Air Girls were as dominating a dynasty as any this state has seen. Doris Boyd, Lucille Mohn, and Lila Boyd left high school without ever losing a game. There were a couple of six-footers on those title teams, like Lucille Mohn, and Lila Boyd could take the ball from one end of the court and hook pass it to the other end. Like most of the players, they were farm girls growing up with a basketball hoop in the hayloft. The routine was simple. Help Dad with the chores, sweep the hay out of the way, hope the dust wasn't too bad, and shoot baskets. Some said the Air Girls played like boys because they played against their brothers in pickup ball. The Boyd and Mohn families contributed 8 players in those dynasty years: Anna, Lila, Doris, and Charlene Boyd, and Lucille, Mildred, Bernice, and Betty Mohn. But when the girls were done with high school basketball, they were done. There was no option to play in college. People who still remember Air basketball wonder how good the girls could have been in college. What if Lila had graduated in 2017 instead of the 1940s? Would she have been a Division I recruit with a college scholarship? Would she have committed to a university program after her junior year? Most likely. Instead, most of the girls went back to the farm or started a life without basketball. The Air School closed in 1969. About all that's left to the town is a large modern elevator, a post office, and Rosie's Cafe. Only 3 streets remain, but the legacy of 109 in a row will last forever. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Jeff Kolpak from his book, North Dakota Tough. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, President Trump is threatening to close the border. So what to do with the latest asylum seekers?
We can feed them, and we're going to help them reunite with their families.
David Green reports from El Paso. Also, a concert pianist has a reunion of his own.
Today, let me look more into the strings. Right?
You just pluck the strings like a guitar.
And then tomorrow, let's...
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, First Link is best known for the 211 hotline, but it also provides other services, including an upcoming course on mental health first aid. On Tuesday, we'll learn more from First Link's Ashley Ladbury-Richena. And as North Dakota starts its medical marijuana program, we'll talk with Max Simon of Greenflower, an organization he founded to gather information about cannabis. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.